Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. And growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Codable co-founder Gretchen Huebner experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a new game artist to grow with her education tech company. But then she switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And by using ZipRecruiter screening questions to filter candidates, Gretchen found it easier to focus on the best ones, then find the right one. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen said she was honestly surprised she found qualified applicants so quickly and hired a new game artist in less than 2 weeks. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good evening. No witnesses, no problems. Thompson's mantra was supposed to be reassuring to the smaller man, but Percy felt the shadow of his own death coming. There was one witness, him, and he cowered, wondering when his neck would be broken, when his body would be ripped apart with bullets. Maybe the youngest son of a violent criminal named Hoggy Thompson was born a beast. Maybe rage was beaten into him. One thing was certain, by the time he reached manhood, Jerry Thompson was a savage killer. He had no conscience about rape, child molestation, or thrashing a dozen men in a prison fight. Once he got his hands on a gun, any target would do. He didn't leave witnesses. When he terrorized an entire courtroom and offered to rip Deputy Prosecutor Larry Sells apart, people wondered if there would ever be a way to stop his viciousness. Now, from the authors of best-selling true crime, Race to Justice, comes an even more frightening story of a monster and what it took to defeat him once and for all. The book that we're featuring this evening is Beast of Newcastle, the heart-pounding battle to stop a savage killer, with my special guests, author Margie Porter and author and attorney Larry Sells. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Margie Porter and Larry Sells. Good evening.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on this incredible tale that you've woven for us. And we get the privilege of listening to you explain this incredible tale today. Let's start off right away with this February 12, 1991. Tell us about Sean McCormick and the purchase of this 12-gauge shotgun at a Kmart in Newcastle. As you write in the book, introduce us to Sean McCormick and Jerry Thompson and this February 12, 1991 in Newcastle, Indiana.
Well, Sean McCormick was a married woman who walked off and left her husband to hang out with a beast called Jerry Thompson. And Jerry Thompson was huge. He was a giant. He was like 6'5" and over 300 pounds. So he was her big, bad boyfriend. She left her husband. She was hanging out with him. he had been in prison most of his life. I mean, from the time he was 12, he was involved in crime. And he had committed violent crimes. I mean, rape, you know, theft, child molestation, battery. He actually threw a man down in prison and scalped a dinner plate-sized tattoo out of the man's flesh and sewed it on his motorcycle jacket. That's how vicious he was.
Incredible.
And this is the man Sean chose to hang around with. So on February 12th, they were in Newcastle. They were living in Indianapolis with a family, and Thompson and Sean had been invited to come and stay by the father of this family. He was living with a family, not so much because they were welcome anymore, but because they were afraid to kick them out. And Thompson pretty much controlled the father and the family. So imagine that your family has this person move in, and they're suddenly dictating everything, and your father is terrified and will not even protect you. That's the position they were in. And Thompson brought his girlfriend, Sean. They lived with the Percy family. So on the day that the shotgun was purchased, Doug Percy, the father, went to Newcastle with Jerry Thompson and Sean, and she bought a shotgun. Now, he gave her the money. He told her exactly what to buy. Later, you know, he would claim that, oh, he was surprised. But he gave her the money, and he told her, you know, this kind of shells, because he wanted the perfect gun. He had been out of prison. He was never going back, and he was in the mood to do some shooting. So Sean went and bought the gun for him. She didn't have any kind of prison record, and so she just filled out the paperwork and chatted with the clerk and said, I'm going to take my father-in-law hunting. You know, we're going to go hunt rabbits. But there weren't any rabbits. It was to kill a man.
Now, this man that you talk about, this man you talk about is Wesley W. Crandall, Jr. He's 40 years old, and you write that he's a small-time drug dealer and apartment manager, and he lives in Newcastle, Indiana, and his friends call him Junior. Tell us about a little bit about Wesley Crandall and his weed in his fridge and other things that he is known for.
So Wesley Crandall had a lot of friends. He was well-known. He was a small-time drug dealer. He sold mostly marijuana, and he rented out some apartments. He was also a very cautious man because he had recently been robbed by some friends of like $30,000 of marijuana. But
right.
He was introduced to Jerry Thompson through a friend, and so that made him part of his inner circle. Thompson went to Newcastle with Doug Percy to see Crandall, you know, supposedly to buy some marijuana to resell, but he took a sawed-off shotgun with him. He had no intention of purchasing the marijuana. He was going to steal it. But again, no witnesses, no problems. So he had every intention of killing this man when he got there. He just didn't tell Doug Percy ahead of time.
Now, what happens when they get there? There's another customer there, Mark Winchester. So
yes,
what
Mark
happens?
Winchester.
And
so Mark Winchester had gone to buy like $60 worth of marijuana, and he did not want to be seen buying marijuana because obviously it's against the law. The apartment building was very, very dark because it was also very, very filthy, and the hallway was narrow. So he saw Doug Percy and Jerry Thompson come in, and he scooted down the hall past them. He got a little bit of a glance at them, but he was mostly trying not to be seen. They came in. Thompson left Percy in the living room, and he said, I'm going into the kitchen to talk to the man. And then Percy heard Thompson knock Wesley Crandall down. Now, Wesley Crandall was just under 6 feet, about 175 pounds. He had no chance against this bigger man. He had guns all over his house. He had pit bulls. He had everything as secure as he knew how to make it. But one punch with this man's fist, and that was pretty much the end of his life. Because after he knocked him out, he leaped up and he stomped on his head. He said, I think I broke his neck. And then that wasn't enough. he wanted to shoot him too. He told Percy to get in there to the refrigerator, come in the room where the man was laying, get into the refrigerator, take the marijuana out. Percy went to do that, and the lock was jimmied. He couldn't get into the refrigerator. So when Thompson came back with a gun, Percy thought, he's going to shoot me for not getting this out of the refrigerator, because he always did everything that Thompson said. It was a matter of personal and family safety that he always did what Thompson said. Well, Thompson came in, he clicked the gun, it misfired, it didn't go off. He went back, he got a second gun, and Percy was just afraid to turn around. He was jerking and jerking and jerking on this refrigerator trying to do what Thompson said, and he hears the second click, and that gun didn't go off. Then Thompson came back with a pillow and a shotgun, and he laid it over this man's head and blasted him into eternity. And poor Percy, he still couldn't get the refrigerator done, and it was just so terrifying. All of a sudden, he sees blood and brain matter spraying across the floor, and he thinks he's next. Well, Thompson was mad, but he was mad enough to break into the refrigerator. So they went off with a bag of marijuana and the shotgun and just left the man laying there. Oh, I'm sorry, they also took the money out of his wallet.
Yeah.
It was a horrendous murder.
Absolutely. Now, at the same time, meanwhile, very soon after, there's an Anna Mae Stewart. She's at home with her son the night of this murder. And there's a knock on the door from a friend named Jeffrey Howe. Tell us what Howe has to say and where Anna Mae Stewart and her son live. Who's the landlord?
They lived just a few streets over in one of Crandall's rented apartments. Jeffrey Howe and Anna Mae Stewart lived in the same building. He had gone to Crandall's house to borrow some ladders and some walkboards. He was going to paint the walls in the apartment building. And he went there, and it was silent, and he just said, something's wrong. Well, since Crandall had been robbed just recently, he didn't want to be caught standing in his apartment. If Crandall came home, he didn't know what had happened because the man's car was there, but nobody seemed to be in the building. So he went to get Anna Mae Stewart because she had been a friend of Crandall's for 17 years, and he would trust her. So they came back, and they went in, and the place was just deadly silent, and they could feel that something was wrong. Well, things always felt wrong in that apartment because it was filthy and, you know, the dog feces, and it was just a deplorable condition. So it never felt like a home. But then there was something just off. And so they were creeping in, and she saw his arm through the kitchen door, you know, where he was lying on the floor, and some blood. And she said, we got to get out of here, because she thought whoever did this could still be here. So they got out, and they went down to a store to use a phone. There were no cell phones then. They went down to use a phone, and they were going to call for an ambulance. But by the time they got there, they realized, no, he's dead. So they called the police instead. And it was just horrifying for them to find him like
that. Absolutely. Now, police are dispatched, but soon the homicide investigation team is called. So that gets the arrival of Detective Captain James Stevens. And he arrives and speaks with the investigator Crabtree of the Newcastle Police Department. What do they find there in terms of weapons and evidence, and what does it point to, and how do they proceed?
Well, the shotgun obviously was not there, and a number of guns had been stolen from the home, but as they went through the house, they found guns everywhere. I mean, in this house, it seems like you could not be anywhere without being hands reach from a gun. And in many places, three guns. So there were a lot of weapons, but most of them were not loaded. Like, there was a shotgun, and it was only loaded with salt. But it looked like he was well-armed against any intruder. They found the refrigerator standing open, the marijuana gone. They, of course, had no leads until another officer went around the neighborhood, and then Gladys Case, the woman across the street, said, oh, I saw the Wolfman leaving that house. Now, the Wolfman, Ralph Jacobs Jr., was a local person. He was mentally retarded. He could not read. He could not write. He was the kind of guy who watched cartoons and ran errands for people and just did the best he could for himself. He lived with his parents. And she said, right. Oh, I saw him leaving with another man. And so the police went looking for him. Well, obviously, the man she saw was not him, but it was Doug Percy. But if you look at the photos in the book, it's eerie how much they look alike.
Absolutely.
So she fingered the wrong man.
Now, this could have been cleared up pretty easily because Ralph says that he was at home and his father backs him up with his son's story. So why do the police not believe his father and that Ralph was home all night?
Well, the father had been in the garage, and he could not swear that Ralph was in the home. And Ralph did run one errand to a store. They didn't question anybody else in the family. They, you know, asked Ralph where he was, and Ralph told them. And Jim Stevens said, no, you were seen. We have a witness. You were there. And he threatened him. He said, you know, your father's terminal. And I'm going to arrest him for lying to the police. You better tell me what I need to know. Ralph had no idea. He didn't know Wesley Crandall. And he certainly had never fired a gun in his life. He was terrified of guns. He was a very gentle soul. You know, just the kind of guy who wanted to be with people and, you know, wanted to be helpful. And he had no way of being involved in this murder. But Stevens kept saying that he was a liar and he didn't believe him. And basically, he told him how it happened and then had him repeat it on tape. He never stood a chance.
Yeah. Now, Detective Stevens gets a call also from to reinforce his ideas, and at least officially, when you look at it officially, Detective Stevens finds a witness named Frank Barber. And what does Frank Barber say? Then we introduce this Charles Alcorn. What does he have to say about Charlie Alcorn?
Charlie Alcorn was the man that Wesley Crandall believed robbed him. And so Jim Stevens gives Ralph the idea that Charlie Alcorn must have been the man with him, because now he knows that he's looking for two killers, not one, because Gladys Case saw two men leaving, and she named the Wolfman. She said, oh, that's him. Everybody knows him. That's what he looks like. I've seen him all the time. She did not personally know him. He was just a character about the town. And so they call in Charlie Alcorn and locked him up, you know, and questioned him. And he said, wait a minute. I've got an alibi. So he was cleared very quickly that it was not him. Then Mark Winchester, the man who was buying marijuana in the beginning, said, right. Oh, no, I saw Smitty. I saw Chris Smith there. He only knew him as Smitty, but he said, that's who the other man was. I got a look at him. He said, you know, everybody knows him. He's got a swollen leg. Then Ralph changed his story to say that he was at Crandall's house with Smitty, and through a series of interviews, he comes around to say, well, I held the pillow over his head, and Smitty shot him. So they arrest Smitty and say, we got a witness that says you killed this man. And Smitty's like, no, I was not there. I was in Kentucky, and I was at home, and I was at all these places. And Jim Stevens says, no. You're lying, and he threatens him. So Smitty was also mentally challenged. He had a background that his parents died young. He took custody of four of his younger siblings, and the welfare department took them away. Now he has a sister, and his sister has young children. And so what does Stephen say to him? If you don't tell me what I need to hear, I'm going to arrest your sister and turn her kids over to the welfare.
Yeah.
And so he cooperated in order to save his sister and her children. It was, I mean, it was a very brave thing for him to do, but all the time he kept saying, I didn't do it, and they said, yes, you did, and we can prove it. And neither of them could even say where the murder weapon was. They didn't know it was a 12-gauge shotgun.
Hey, bear in mind that Christopher Smith was 5'9", 174 pounds, and he was the other person who actually was Jerry Thompson, 6'5", 300 pounds. Now, how could Winchester make that kind of a mistake? And how how could James Stevens believe that?
But as you write in the initial, and it must have been reflected in the police reports, Mark Winchester intentionally or didn't get a really good look. That should have been
Correct.
Taken into consideration.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't. He. So
now,
these two men who could not have committed this murder were now being charged with it, and they were locked down, not able to see their families, and of course they didn't have the ability to know what to do, and they had signed away all of their rights. They signed away their Miranda rights. They had no legal recourse whatsoever except to do what the attorney said.
Now with this, they both have attorneys, but the attorneys are advising them to take these deals that eventually are offered to them. What's the deal offered to Smith, and what's the deal offered to Jacobs?
Jacobs was told to take the Class C felony, that, you know, battery, and he got 8 years. He agreed to 8 years. It could have been 2 to 8 years, but the judge said there were mitigating circumstances, and he gave him the maximum penalty. And in the meantime, Crandall's sister was saying, no, he should serve more time, but the law did not allow more time. Smith was told that if he went to trial, he would get 30 to 60 years, and he signed a plea for 38 because he thought it was the best deal he could get. And his attorney said, you need to accept this deal because Ralph Jacobs is going to come in there and finger you, and you'll get the max. So he signed away 38 years of his life.
Incredible. How did Jerry Thompson feel at this time about this development in this murder?
Oh, when he saw it in the papers, he was euphoric. You know, he'd taken cash and marijuana, and there were no witnesses, and he could use the guns that he'd stolen from there, and he could do as he pleased because he was truly in a mood to shoot people. He was, you know, free from prison. He wasn't ever going back because if anybody saw him, he was going to shoot them. We don't actually know how many people he shot. We know that, you know, we know of four. We don't know if there were more because he was simply, I can do as I please, and I will shoot people if I want to. And so he was a wild man on the loose.
You write in this book, Beast of Newcastle, about, again, I don't want to overstate it, but the horrendous background of Jerry Thompson, the upbringing. Tell us what you found about his upbringing, his family background.
I don't think you can overstate it, Dan. His father brutalized him. His father brutalized all of his children. He beat them. He starved them. He would make them fight each other for food. He drank up all the money. He even stole and sodomized pigs. That's why they called him Hoggy Thompson. And he put them in houses that I wouldn't put my dog in. I mean, there were rats, and there was usually no plumbing, you know, maybe an outhouse outside, places that were crumbling, and obviously no comfort, you know, warmth and all of that. And the daughter, Susan, would actually follow her dad to the bars, and when he got drunk enough, she would steal some of his money so they could buy food. And the mother, Sarah, taught them to steal from the store. because that was the only way they could survive. So she worked multiple jobs, but there was no way that she could feed five kids and give them the necessities when her husband was beating her all the time and taking the money and drinking it all up. So as far as family background, it was horrible. I just can't imagine what these children endured. And yet, four of them grew up to be pretty decent. In
right.
fact, the sister Susan became a nurse.
Right. Now, you talk about September 4th, 1991, Kathy Boggs, a 29-year-old, and Alan White is 39. They're going to see Jerry Thompson. What are they going to see Jerry Thompson about at this bar?
He owed her money, and she wanted it back. And so they went together to confront him about the money. And later, I think it was the same night, they were found shot in a garage at close range, and Jerry Thompson's handprint was on the window, but he was never arrested. That wasn't enough evidence. So he went to see Doug Percy a couple of days after that to tell him that he'd done it, but Percy couldn't do anything. First of all, Thompson was a threat to his family, and now also he was involved in a murder. You know, not that he knew the murder was going to happen, but the Crandall murder was hanging over his head. And Thompson was showing himself to be more and more violent. He and his brother beat a man up and kicked the man until his eye fell out. And Percy was defenseless against this man. So he heard the story and could do nothing. But he was getting more and more afraid of his family and himself, of course. I mean, we're talking about a man who can kill you with his fist, recreationally.
Now, how do they get into a situation where police are involved and they get arrested, not for this, but for something else, but there's a situation where Percy actually needs Jerry Thompson's help? What's the situation? Explain that for us.
Doug Percy was the kind of man who helped everybody. He was hardworking. He took care of his family. He helped people repair their vehicles. He himself was looking for a car. I'm sorry, I lost my focus. What was the question?
I think I can provide some help here. Dan?
Sure.
Sure. Jump in.
In June 1991, Doug Percy elicited the assistance of Jerry Thompson to go to Texas with him to try to find somebody that Doug Percy had provided money for this person to make his bail and get out of jail. Well, he absconded. He fled the state, went to Texas. So Doug asked Jerry Thompson to go with him when he got stopped in Illinois.
Now, with this as well, they get stopped by police. What do they find in this vehicle? And what is Jerry Thompson's reaction and Doug Percy's to this?
Well, the Illinois State Police officer that stopped them found an M11 machine gun type gun and a black handgun, which was a 9mm, that they had with them. Jerry had the 9mm, and that's a gun that he had obtained from the robbery and murder of Wesley Crandall. The M11 right. came from there as well, but the 9mm was used in another murder just a month after Wesley Crandall's murder. But the people in Illinois didn't know about that when he was stopped in June of 91. They
right.
Arrested him, but they let him go and kept the guns. And then later, both of them, in early March of 1992, were arrested on essentially auto theft charges. It's being in possession of a vehicle with altered vehicle identification numbers.
Right.
And they were locked up, and they both, one of them made bond, Douglas Piercy. Jerry Thompson couldn't make bond because he was on parole, and the parole authorities put a hold on him. And while Doug Piercy was out, he felt free, especially after Jerry Thompson had called him multiple times and threatened him and his family, said he's going to reach out and touch him if Piercy said anything. He felt free to do what he felt like he should have done all along, and that's go to the authorities and tell them what he knew about Thompson, which is what he did. On March 18, 1992, he went to talk to the police about what Jerry Thompson had done and what he had seen him do, including the murder of Wesley Crandall and the murder of two other gentlemen, Melvin Hillis and Robert Bielern, in Indianapolis in the, at the Hillis Auto Sales lot.
Now, they must have deemed his evidence credible because they have two people convicted for the Crandall murder, so he must have gave evidence and details that could be corroborated by at least by the police, so that there was no way that he could have been making up this tale.
You know what he told
right.
them? He told them where they could find the guns that mm-hmm. Jerry Thompson had taken in the murder of Wesley Crandall. Of course, there was paperwork to show that Crandall had purchased those guns and that he had them. And that was at the Indiana State Police. They went there, Indianapolis law enforcement went to the Illinois State Police and happened to get there right before those guns were going to be destroyed. And the main gun was that 9mm gun that Jerry Thompson had used to kill Melvin Hillis and Robert Bieler. Well, that gun in hand and the information they had from Doug Piercy was sufficient then for the officials in Newcastle in the Henry County Prosecutor's Office to reinvestigate the case and discover that they'd convicted the wrong people.
Absolutely.
Percy also sketched the murder scene in detail that nobody would be able to do unless they were there. The position of the body and where he was standing in front of the refrigerator, and even like the, a picture of one of the knives that was taken. He sketched it out, and it was obvious that he had been there and knew what happened.
So eventually, after Christopher Smith and Jacobs were locked up for nearly 18 months, information was provided that allowed their convictions to be set aside and they were released. I'm going to tell you one horrendous incident that occurred. Christopher Smith had an affliction called elephantitis of his left leg. And he could barely walk. He walked like, like Chester from Gunsmoke. Well, he was brought back from the prison system and at the Henry County Jail. He wasn't even given another set of clothes. He had his prison wear. And he, no one took him home either. The law enforcement didn't offer him a ride home. They just pushed him out the door, and he had to hobble walk home. And on the way, a Newcastle police officer stopped and rolled down his window and said to Christopher Smith, "Better not see him after dark." So, I mean, he just added that to what he had already experienced. Christopher Smith, when he was at Pendleton, had a nervous breakdown. He was in such poor health, I'm surprised he even survived the year and a half that he was confined. And later, both he and Ralph Jacobs received payments from the state of Indiana based upon a lawsuit that had been filed. Do you want to tell them about that, Margie, or should I?
So an attorney filed against the state for wrongful imprisonment and all that they had endured at the hands of the authorities and filed lawsuits for $50.9 million on behalf of each of them. They actually received $605,000 for Christopher Smith and $435,000 for Jacobs. And neither Ralph Jacobs nor Christopher Smith lived but a few months after that. Their health was so broken from all that they had endured. Of course, they weren't real healthy to begin with because they had physical problems, but they didn't live long enough to even spend it. It was just tragic. I don't have a better word than tragic for what happened to these men.
So all of the investigation by the Anniston police proved to them that neither Ralph Jacobs or Christopher Smith had anything to do with Wesley Crandall's murder. And the inquiring Captain James Stevens took off for Florida. He didn't even stick around. But here's something that Stevens absolutely overlooked. Anna Stewart, the friend of Wesley Crandall's, told law enforcement that Crandall had machine gun, the M11, a pit bull gun, which is an oversized handgun, and a black 9mm handgun. Well, Stevens didn't even bother to find out whether or not Smith or Jacobs had anything like that in their possessions. He was also told about all the drugs that were in the house and knew that they were kept in the refrigerator. He didn't even inquire about whether or not Jacobs or Smith had any marijuana or any of those drugs in their possession. And also, I mean, he was such a great detective that after the authorities came, the coroner's office, to pick up Mr. Crandall, he didn't even look in his jacket where there was almost $1,400 in cash. Just a terrible investigation job, and as well, the way that these men were treated when they were forced to confess, just an abomination. And yet, Mr. Stevens went down to Florida and enjoyed himself while these two mentally retarded guys were stuck in prison, just withering away and dying.
Absolutely.
I don't know how he could live with himself.
Let's go to the first trial and the highlights of that with Prosecutor Edwards. Tell us what happens at this trial and the testimony of Doug Percy.
So this would be the trial in Newcastle before Larry was involved. And
Right. They
had to prove that Ralph Jacobs and Christopher Smith were not responsible for this murder. And they had to prove that Jerry Thompson committed the murder. And, of course, they had Doug Percy's testimony. There were issues with why did these men confess to a murder they didn't commit. And they were browbeaten because they had confessed in court, basically, quote-unquote, lied in court about a crime they could not have committed. And so the defense pounced on them saying, well, why did you say this if it wasn't true? And how convenient is it that, you know, you're saying, Jim Stevens told me this, Jim Stevens told me that. And when they tried to explain that they had been intimidated, they didn't really have the vocabulary, actually, to explain what happened. And so it took some doing for the prosecution to get them ruled out because the defense was so into proving that Thompson could not have done it and they had the right men. But they did get Thompson convicted and they did get him sentenced to 60 years plus 30 years because he was like a habitual offender. So Thompson was sentenced to 90 years before the other trial even started for Crandall's murder.
Right. Now let's talk about the Indianapolis murders and what Percy had said about that and what evidence he provided for that, Larry.
Well, Percy gave, over the course of the time the cases were pending against Jerry Thompson, somewhere around six different times he gave either sworn testimony or statements, and it was consistent throughout. His description of what occurred at the car lot, at the Hills Auto Sales car lot, was very specific and detailed. And the only way that he could have known those things that he told the police is if he was there and he did it, or he saw somebody else do it. And Doug Piercy was not a big fella. He was a slight individual, and Jerry Thomas was at least twice as big as he was. And you could tell while talking to Doug Piercy that he's absolutely petrified of him, even though Jerry Thomas was locked up.
Hush.
Whoops. I'll tell you, my first experience with Jerry Thompson, I walked into the courtroom when he was brought in for his initial hearing to have the charges explained to him and his rights. I looked at the guy, and you could just see an aura of evil. I've had other defendants that are prosecuted on murder charges that seem to emit the same aura. I had a bisexual man who engaged in anally raping and strangling young black women, and you could just see it and feel it. I had a manipulative temptress who I dubbed a female Charles Manson that seduced others to do her bidding, including killing people, and you could see it and sense it with her. Well, the same thing with Jerry Thompson, probably even more so because of his size. You could just look at him and see that. I mean, it was... I'm not a little guy. I'm 6'3", and at the time weighed around 200 pounds. Gained a little weight since then, but he dwarfed me. I felt small compared to him. And I wasn't scared of him, probably because there were armed deputies in the courtroom. But right. There was an incident that probably shows how his size and demeanor would intimidate people. He had a small lawyer there to represent him, court-appointed lawyer to represent him on the initial hearing. And I'm by right. small, I mean 640 pounds wet. And the deputies brought him in there, and they had told Jerry Thompson into the courtroom. But before that, they had told this lawyer, sit as far away from this guy as you can. He's killed several people, and he hates lawyers. Well, they brought Jerry Thompson in and set him down at the end of the table and the lawyers at the other end of the table about 8 feet away. Well, Jerry Thompson immediately scoots his chair right up next to that lawyer. And the lawyer's just shaking at his boots. He can't wait for the court proceedings to be over because he's scared of this fella. When it's over, he walks over to the deputies after Jerry Thompson's been taken to the lockup behind the court, and he says, "Why didn't you guys stop him? Didn't you see what he was doing?" And they just laughed. He said, "What are you laughing about?"
Yeah.
He said, "Well, we told him that he better get close to you because you're hard of hearing." And that lawyer, besides shaking his boots, got a little red in the face and stormed out of the courtroom. That just shows you that the effect that Jerry Thompson could have on people.
Absolutely.
Dan, if you ever see a video of Sally Jesse Raphael, I think it's from 1993, and Larry is on there talking about a murder. David Martinet is on there, and you can see how little he is.
Yeah.
He would absolutely have been terrified next to Jerry Thompson.
Right. Now, you talk about this Melvin Hillis and Robert Beeler murder. The state wants the death penalty, so David Martinet is out, and some more experienced attorneys come in because it's a death penalty case. You have an assistant named Commons, and you got all the evidence from the trial to be able to do this. Tell us about the crime itself. What Doug Piercy described happened at this auto center.
Well, Doug Piercy worked at the Kroger Bakery, which was near this car lot on the southeast side of Indianapolis, and he was looking for a car to purchase. Jerry Thompson was with him, but on the way to work, he pulled into the lot because he had seen this black Buick that he really had his eye on. He went into the dealership. Jerry Thompson stayed out in the car, and he asked if he could have the keys so he could start the car and look inside under the hood at the engine. And he went in, did it, started it, and he went back, took the keys back, and he was talking to these Robert Beeler and Melvin Hillis, and he was joking with them. He said, "You know, this got a little leak in the head gasket, oil leak. Is there any way I could get a this at a better price?" And they just laughed at him and said, No, I wouldn't fix that head gasket for you, but price is going to stay the same. Just then, the doorway fills with this huge man with his black gun in his hand, this 9mm Stollard semi-automatic. And he just pushes Doug Percy out of the way. He immediately fires shots at the Melvin Hillis sitting across the room. It's a really small office. Hillis is hitting the stomach and in the side and pushes him up against the wall. Robert Beeler sitting across the room, probably not more than 10 feet away in a chair by his desk. And he dives under the desk when that happens. Jerry Thompson just reaches under there and shoots him right in the chin. The bullet penetrates his head and kills him. He shoots Melvin Hillis some more. And of course, kills Melvin Hillis. The bullet severs his spine and kills him. And Doug Pierce is witnessing this. Of course, bear in mind, he's just seen a month before Jerry Thompson take a shotgun and nearly blow Wesley Crandall's head off there in Newcastle. So he just stands there doing nothing. And Thompson grabs money off the desk that was there from the daily proceeds at the car lot. And he also starts going through the pockets of Beeler and Hillis and tells Doug Piercy to help him gather up money and other things of value, and tells him to get in the file cabinets to see what he can find. Of course, Percy's doing everything he tells him. And Thompson throws this stuff in the middle of the floor that he's gotten out of the pockets, and he tells Percy to pick it up and bring it with him. And Percy does it. He just saw two guys executed, gunned down in that office, and he didn't want a bullet in his head. And he describes all that in his testimony and all the statements he gave and the depositions, and he was consistent throughout. So we tried Mr. Thompson initially, and the jury gets to hear about the case in Newcastle because the law at that time allowed this prosecution to present evidence on where and under what circumstances a person received or got the instrumentality that they used to commit the murder they're being tried for. So I got to tell him about the murder of Wesley Crandall and the conviction there where he was sentenced to 90 years, and the law allowed that. And also, after hearing the evidence from Doug Piercy on the witness stand and some of the corroborating evidence, the jury heard that and convicted him and then sentenced him to death.
Right.
A year later, the Supreme Court started to rethink that obtaining the instrumentality case law and said, well, we don't think that's right that this jury who's trying a fellow for two murders gets to hear he's been convicted of a murder before. So you can tell the jury that he stole the guns from Wesley Crandall, but you can't tell them what else happened. So in other words, I'm supposed to lie to the jury. Well, they took away a big part of her evidence.
Yeah, incredible.
You want me to stop?
One of the interesting things that happens at trial, dramatic things that happen at trial, among some of the more dramatic things, one of those dramatic things is these guys, like you, Margie, had mentioned, they don't really have a vocabulary to be able to defend themselves and sort of explain this intimidation. But there was one thing where you said that his attorney actually slipped up, Baldwin, and opened the door to what happened in this dramatic exchange about why he would have let, or why did he wait so long before he came to police? What was it that pushed him over? Tell us what that dramatic scene was and why.
Well, Jeff Baldwin is doing his job trying to challenge the credibility of a major witness against his client, Doug Percy. And he asked him, he said, well, why'd you wait so long? Why are we to believe you here? Why did you come forward? he said, well, Jerry Thompson was living in my house. And the first opportunity I got to come forward, I did. And Baldwin says, well, why, though? Because he molested my daughter.
Yeah.
That's one reason I came forward. And that pretty much shut Baldwin up. You know, the jury, after the jury heard that, they didn't want to hear any more about Jerry Thompson. That did it for them. They'd already heard about some brutal murders, and hearing that he had molested Doug Percy's daughter, that was sort of icing on the cake for the state's case.
Right. Now,
Doug's daughters were 8 to 13 years old. And in another statement, he said that Thompson molested his youngest daughter. The twins were 8. It was enough to infuriate the jury for sure.
Certainly. Now, Larry, you have to prepare for this second death penalty case, but you don't have the benefit of that past prior murder and that connection with the weapons. So how do you prepare for this? And give us some of the dramatic things that happened. You have, you are very passionate about this death penalty and this person deserving of that. And you said that there was all kinds of advocates and, you know, experts, death penalty, anti-death penalty people involved in this. Regardless of this guy being a beast, regardless, these factions were still in this courtroom. So tell us a little bit about this second death penalty case trial.
Well, as you indicated, there were, I don't know, at least a dozen lawyers there that were anti-death penalty, that were involved themselves in appeals on death penalty cases, and they were there to assist the defense. And the defense had one of the best lawyers in Indianapolis, a fellow by the name of David Hennessy. Another person, Joe Cleary, was the co-counsel, and he had written the briefs on the appeal that where Jerry Thompson's conviction was overturned. So you got two really sharp guys there. Well, I didn't have any novice in my corner. I had a fellow by the name of Mark Massa, who was chief counsel in the prosecutor's office. He wanted to sit on a death penalty case and asked me if he could sit with me on this one. And I said, sure. Well, Mark Massa is now an Indiana Supreme Court justice. That shows you, you know, the caliber of his mental acuities. Well, he was there with me. But there were seemed like every day there were people there trying to encourage and help Mr. Hennessy to defend Jerry Thompson. So we had that to contend with. But that just provided me more motivation to make sure I convicted this guy. I'll tell you, during a death penalty case is a two-part proceeding. First, there's the guilt phase. The state has to present evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this person has committed these crimes. And then if he's convicted of murder for those, then the state can proceed with the penalty phase. Well, after the guilty phase, when we were giving, after the evidence had been presented, Mark Massa provided the first argument for the state of Indiana. And then David Hennessy gave his argument. And Dave's a brilliant lawyer. He did a great job. The judge took a recess, and I was in the restroom, and I ran into Dave there, and I told him, I said, Dave, you know, that was an absolutely great argument. And he said, thank you. But what I was thinking was, but watch this. I'm going to raise two guys from the dead. So I went back in to give my final argument. And I talked to him about Doug Percy's testimony, the jury, and why they should believe it. And then I said, you know, I wish there were two more people that were actually there at the scene that could tell you what happened in that little office. And I said, wait a minute. I looked up to the ceiling, of the courtroom, and I motioned. I said, Melvin Hillis, come down here and tell these people what this big guy over here did to you. And Hennessey just went absolutely nuts. He objected. He said, you know, judge, this shouldn't be allowed. This is up at the bench where the jury couldn't hear it. This shouldn't be allowed. This isn't real. This is, you know, it's something that shouldn't be permitted. And the judge says, no, Mr. Hennessey, I want to see where this goes. So I had Hillis describe, based on the evidence the jury had already heard, what Jerry Thompson had done to him. You know, he said he saw this big guy fill in the doorway and this big black gun in his hand. I felt two bullets jam me up against the wall. You know, I had him go through what had happened. And there was forensic evidence to support what he was saying, but I wanted to do it in a sort of a dramatic way so the jury would maybe be impacted by it, maybe biased a little bit. That's terrible, I know, but... And then I finished with him, and I commenced to call Robert Beeler down and have him tell the jury what happened to him. And I just thought, you know, if a jury heard that, that they might add that a little bit to the evidence that they heard from Doug Percy. The big thing about Doug Percy's testimony was that, you know, he told law enforcement where the gun was, and that gun that was used to kill these guys, Beeler and Hillis, was then found in Illinois, just like he said it had been taken there from them. And the officer had taken it right from the seat area where Jerry Thompson was. It was Jerry Thompson's favorite gun. And that gun then was positively identified as a murder weapon in killing Hillis and Beeler.
Right.
So, and the way... Doug Percy described the events that occurred in that little office. He either had to have been there and done it himself, or had to have been there and seen somebody else do it. And the jury got to see the comparative sizes of the two. Plus, Percy worked every day, supported his family, even took in Thompson and his girlfriend to live there in the house with him, even though he didn't want him there. I mean, he was, out of the goodness of his heart, he did that. And you compare that to, and I did this, to Jerry Thompson, he wasn't even working. If he was working, he wasn't making much. He was living off another family. And I gave the jury that to consider in determining who had the motive or who was more likely to have committed the crimes, and consider that along with the other evidence. And he was convicted. And we proceeded then to the penalty phase.
It's interesting, too, when you talk, because he is excited. Along with his attorneys, they're encouraged because the jury comes back in 2 hours. This is a more difficult case than you tried before.
That's in the penalty part, right.
Oh, pardon me. Sorry. Okay. Well, let's get to that.
No, that's okay.
Let's get to the penalty phase. And when
something really exciting happened.
Yes, absolutely. I want to talk about that. His mother on the stand and all the pleas for whatever they would have to say that you refuted about why he shouldn't be killed. Tell us about that dramatic testimony and his reaction.
You've already heard about the mother and the family and the horrors that they had growing up, the kids did, and the wife of Hoggy Thompson, and Jerry Thompson and his three brothers and sister living there in that household and treated like, well, probably less than animals, really. They were just treated horribly. And I could see while the mother was testifying about all the terrible things that happened and what the kids had to go through growing up, that the jury, even though they'd heard about the really horrific things that Jerry Thompson had done in killing Beeler and Hillis, I could see that they were starting to be a little sympathetic. And I thought, man, I got to find some way to change the dynamics of this, because I'm going to try to convince a jury that they should recommend a death sentence for this guy. And he's just been sitting there like a big old teddy bear or Boy Scout. I mean, I don't know if they'd given him some sedatives for the trial, the defense, or not, but he just sitting there, stoic and well-behaved. Damn it, they got to see this guy the way he really is. So the defense finished their direct examination, and I started mine, and I sympathized with the mother for what the family had been through. And I said, how many other siblings were there in the family? Three brothers and a sister. She said, yes. And they went through the same thing. They had to live the same horrors growing up. Yes. And I looked right over at Jerry, and the question was kind of addressed to his mother. Jerry, and I said, how many people did they kill? Man, he exploded out of his chair. I think Margie describes it in the book with the jury looking like they were looking down the maw of a T-Rex. I mean, he was that big and frightening. And the judge, the female judge, Judge Tanya Walton Pratt, who's now a federal judge, she dived underneath the bench there, the chair, I mean, off her chair under the bench. I looked at the jury, and they damn near broke the backs of their chairs trying to get away from this big old guy, this grizzly bear that was yelling at them. And I looked over at Jerry, and, of course, he wasn't real happy with me all the way through the trial, but he looked like he was ready to kill me, too. And I just mouthed the words, thank you. Because he had just given me justification to argue why this guy could not be controlled. If he couldn't be controlled in an environment where he knew his life was in jeopardy, just been convicted of murder, and the jury was hearing evidence to try to determine whether or not to recommend the death sentence, if he couldn't be controlled under those circumstances with five or six armed deputies around him, then how could he possibly be controlled in the general prison population or anywhere else? So I was thankful that at least he showed his true colors. And I definitely took advantage of that when I argued the case for the death penalty to the jury.
Mm-hmm. And like I had mentioned, 2 hours is encouraging for him, for Thompson and his attorneys. But what was the outcome?
Yeah, you know, they just won just a couple years before an appeal. And that, you know, they were feeling pretty good because even though he'd been convicted, they felt like if a jury came back in 2 hours, there's no way that they were going to, under those circumstances, recommend the death sentence. And I was beginning to wonder myself. I felt pretty good about the jury we had, even though I'd kept two ministers on the jury. And I was criticized by fellow deputy prosecutors about that. They said, you know, no minister's going to recommend a death sentence on a case. I said, I think these guys will. One of them's a Southern Baptist. He's been looking at this guy with these tattoos all over him, even though the defense tried to cover it up, this great big guy, the way he exploded in the courtroom. I think based upon what they've heard about the things he's done, and at that time they heard about the Crandall murder as well, because we were allowed to present that in the death penalty phase. I thought we were on pretty safe grounds, even with those ministers. But I began to wonder, you know, back this quick, there's no way they could recommend a death sentence. But they did. When the jury read that, you know, at first the defense was numb, and then they were consoling their client, but he didn't have any, he didn't pay any attention to them. He was looking over at me, trying to find some way to get back at me. But by that time, because of the outburst in the courtroom, the judge felt like he needed to be restrained for the proceedings. So he was put in chains, his hands, his legs, and he sat through the rest of the proceedings that way. Even though I might have been a little concerned about whether the deputies could, armed deputies could get there in time, I didn't have a whole lot of concern about him being able to get over to me with all those chains on him.
Yeah.
Now, the court tried to make those make it so the jury couldn't see the chains during the penalty phase mm-hmm. after the outburst by putting a skirt around the defense table to hide them and also a skirt around the prosecution's table so they'd look the same. Plus, the jury knew something was going on, and they really knew something was going on when during the trial from time to time I'd walk over near Jerry Thompson, and when I did, he'd move and the chains would rattle. So they knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But he absolutely hated me. And I don't know what my life would have been worth or how long I would have been around this planet if he hadn't been so restrained.
Now, you write that the story isn't quite over because he meets a woman named Jackie Bloomer, and they get married. They fall in love, of course. But a couple years later, and, you know, this interesting is Jerry Thompson was in so many years in prison, he ends up being an enforcer in prison years before. So this is a tough guy in prison. Like you say, ripping a tattoo, cutting a tattoo off a guy, sewing it onto his jacket. But a couple of years later, October 27, 2002, what kind of rough justice happened to Jerry Thompson?
Well, you think I ought to give this spoiler? Mark, you'll
okay,
kill me
let,
if I
let,
say it.
Well, I won't kill you, but I think they should read it in the book. I think the book describes it better than we could.
Absolutely.
Nobody could
Larry
describe it.
Him.
Yeah, that's right. You do describe it better than I could. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The thing is that Larry sent this man to death row twice. And so people will wonder, well, how did he get off death row the first time? But it's more interesting to find out how he got off the second time.
Yeah.
And I really
absolutely.
Think that they should read that in the book.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Hey, I got a little story I want to tell you, and it won't take long. But in the first trial, you know, all kinds of prospective jurors are brought in, summoned in for jury service in the death penalty case. They have to fill out a very intrusive questionnaire that the defense has put together. Well, in the first trial, I had an interesting thing occur. One of the jurors, and this was in 1996, was in his 60s, but he was retired from the military, and he had served in Korea. Well, he, on his jury questionnaire, indicated he was opposed to the death penalty. Man, I was scratching my head over that one. How could he be? So I thought I'd ask him a few questions. And I said, sir, you've indicated that you're against the death penalty. Is that right? He said, yes. You also said you were in the Korean War. You were over there in Korea, and you actually fought. You shot at people, and people shot at you? He said, yes. Then why are you against the death penalty? He said, I'll tell you, sir, if this guy did what you said he did, and we find him guilty, then you ought to take him right outside the courthouse and hang him from the nearest tree. But you won't do that. So I'm against the death penalty. I said, well, shouldn't he deserve at least an appeal? He said, no appeal. Just take him out their name. Well, he didn't get to serve as you might expect.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting exchange. I thanked him for his service.
Absolutely. I want to thank you both for coming on and talking about Beast of Newcastle, the heart-pounding battle to stop a savage killer. For those people that might want to find out more about this, can you tell us about your newsletter? And this is a Wild Blue Press release. Tell us about how they might contact you.
We're on Author Central and Wild Blue Press and also on Amazon. Our book is also available online at Barnes & Noble.
Hey, anybody can look at either site. Probably on Race to Justice, there's something about the authors, and it'll tell you a little more about each one of us if they care to read about it.
Absolutely. Yes, well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's an incredible book. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about The Beast of Newcastle, The Heart-Pounding Battle to Stop a Savage Killer, Larry Sells
the only
and
other,
Margie
sorry.
Porter. Go ahead.
The only other thing they might want to know is do not read this at home alone in the dark. Because it really is creepy. I mean, this is the creepiest killer I have ever heard of. And I applaud Larry for standing up to him.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fascinating.
I applaud Margie for writing a great book.
Absolutely. You both have put together an incredible book and taking us right into the courtroom and right into the lives of these very, very colorful investigators and wrongfully convicted. It's a heart-rending story with somewhat of a happy ending, if there can be such a thing. Thank you very much for Beast of Newcastle. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.